Hi, I'm Stacey Shoemaker-Rowan, Editor-in-Chief of Hospitality Design Magazine, with HD's What I've Learned podcast. Today, I chatted with Margaret McMahon, Managing Director and Senior Vice President of Wimberly Interiors. She started her design career with Tricia Wilson when she wasn't sure what she wanted to do, but she ended up finding what she calls her addiction. After 3 decades, she left to start up the interior design arm of WATG. 8 years later, Wimberly has multiple offices and a list of great projects, further solidifying her as a heavyweight in the industry. And to hear her tell it, it's due to being fearless and taking risks. This week's podcast is sponsored by Global Allies. I'm here with Adam from Global Allies. Adam, your chairs are made specifically for hotel guest rooms?
Yep, that's right.
Global Allies, chairs for hotels. Hi, I'm here with Margaret McMahon, Senior Vice President and Managing Director of Wimberly Interiors and a dear friend. Hi, Margaret. Thank you so much, Stacey, for being here.
Happy birthday, honey.
Thank you. Thank you. Getting a little bit older. But, you know, the whole idea of this podcast is what I've learned. And you've had such an amazing career. And we're such big fans of all you do that we're so excited for you to share a little bit about your life story. So let's start at the beginning. You grew up in New York, right?
Yes.
Okay. And so did you always know you wanted to be a designer? Was there anything from your childhood that led you to this amazing career?
Absolutely not. Aside from my mother taking me to Krauss Paint Store in Bayside, I grew up in Douglaston, actually with Deborah Burke.
We grew up
in the same town.
Oh, I didn't know that.
My mother would take us to Krauss & Sons on Bell Boulevard in Bayside, and we got to pick out the wall covering for our bedrooms. That's as far as it ever went. That is as far as it ever went.
So there's no school for design, no.
So I went to, I was a public school kid until my parents realized that I had a behavior problem. Sent me to an all-girls Catholic school in Manhasset, where I graduated, God, I think everything was yesterday. I graduated in the 70s, where they thought that the main skill that you need to have was typing. But I was going to become a lawyer. That was my goal. And really, I think I said I was going to become a lawyer because it sounded good, really. Plus, I loved to argue. So I was going to be a lawyer. I was going to be a lawyer.
And so I love this story. I know this story, but I'll prompt you for the story. So you fell into design via a temp service called Kelly Services.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about how that happened?
So when I got out of college, my dad was a doctor and he had 4 kids in college at the same time. And he said, and my brother went to school for oceanography. He went to school for all sorts of things. And he was in a private flight school called Embry-Riddle. That was super expensive. So my timing wasn't great. When I went to my dad, I said, I'd like to go to law school. And he said, good for you. Now, as soon as you figure out how to pay for that, you're off to the races. So my coping skills were to go windsurfing and smoke pot all summer. So my mother, who had been accessories editor of Harper's Bazaar magazine before she got married, she was a real smart lady, looked at me and realized that I was a kid in crisis, not knowing what I wanted to do. So she pulled me aside at the end of the summer and said, listen, you got to go get a job. And she goes, I know you don't know what you want to do. She goes, but I'm pretty darn sure you don't want to be a lawyer. She said, I want you to go to Kelly Services in New York and try all sorts of jobs to figure out what it is that you want to do. And really, I look at that, my mother was my first mentor for sure. So I went into Kelly Services. They asked if I could type, and I said, yeah, I can just type anybody out of a typing pool. And they said, can you cut mat board? And I said, yes, I can. I had taken art classes in college. That was sort of the extent of my art career. And my first temp job, they said, this is interesting. Someone's looking for someone who can type and can cut mat board at the same time. And the name of the company is Tricia Wilson Associates. They are up on 39 East 67th Street. And we're going to arrange for you to go have a meeting with them. So Tricia Wilson was my first job.
Yeah.
That's how I got into it.
Kind of amazing.
Yeah.
What was it like working with Tricia?
Well, I didn't work with Tricia. I worked with a woman named Liz Morehouse, who was just an amazing woman, super, super talented. And it was just her. So I walked in, and I don't know where I got these skills from. And I know as I get older, my sort of OCD gets just so revved up now. But I walked into this place and I realized that she was by herself and she needed help. So what I was there for was to help put together the, they were doing the Bankers Trust offices in Cairo, Egypt. So I was cutting mat board and helping putting together a presentation. So that, you know, that took a couple of days, big deal. In the meantime, I was answering phones and typing some stuff, but I started to look around and I said to her, you know, you have this room next door that's piled with fabric books and stuff. Do you want me to help you get organized? And really, the way I think that they saw me was someone who was willing to roll up their sleeves and do whatever it took to get a job done. I think that that was really the premise of, you know, how I connected. So it was with Liz Morehouse. And then the first time Trisha Wilson came to town, I met this woman from Texas that was just amazing. And she had asked me, she said, listen, would you run down the street and get me Entenmann's Donuts? I said, sure, no problem. So that was my first intro to Trisha and meeting her. And that's really a true story because maybe 5 years ago, Sue Wade, who, you know, works for Ritz, we were working on, I think it was Ritz Naples with Host, and she pulled me to the side of the room. I hadn't seen her in years. And she said, I have to apologize to you. And I said, oh, God, what for? She said, I just felt so badly all those years ago when Trisha would ask you to go get her donuts. And I, and you know, for some people, I think, listen, I even look at staff in my office now, and I wouldn't dream of asking them things like that. Actually, I would, but I know that there's a line that you really shouldn't cross. But I had no problem doing anything that I was asked to do, you know? So I think that she just realized that, and it wasn't the Entenmann's donut test by any stretch, but I think that the fact that I would dig in and do whatever it took resonated with them. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's not an easy lesson to learn. You either have it or you don't, right?
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah. I think that is true. And what is interesting, I say to people all the time, and I say this all the time only because it's so true, Trisha Wilson saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. And, you know, a lot of times to peel back the layers, and a lot of it's exposure, right. You know? I grew up in a great neighborhood, but I didn't grow up where families were hiring interior designers to come in and redo their houses. You know, that wasn't how I grew up. Now, maybe there were other families in Douglaston who did it, but my father was sort of a family doctor who took care of people for a very minimal amount of money, and he was raising four kids. And, you know, my mother took an upholstery class. She was learning how to do upholstery. I still have the chair of my house. But I didn't have that exposure. And I always say to my teams, this is one thing that I say to my teams is, you know, in this day and age when we're all walking down the street looking at our phones, you have to look up. And you have to look up and you have to see what's around you because there's so many things that you could miss. And I was lucky back then that there were so few distractions that I could see those opportunities in front of me that I might have missed.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. What were some of your best memories working at Wilson? Any projects? I mean, you were there for what, 3 decades almost?
20? Yeah, 3 decades makes it sound
sorry,
so
almost 30 years.
God darn long. You know, it's interesting because one of my best friends it works for MasterCard. She had emailed me recently and said, didn't you work on the Ronald McDonald House in New York? And I said, yeah. At the time, it was the largest Ronald McDonald House in the world. And we had done it with John Tishman. We had been working on the Dolphin and the Swan. And I have to say, and she said, you know, they're having their anniversary. I don't want to say how many years anniversary. They're having their anniversary and they want to talk to you about it, about, you know, they want you to see the house where it is now. And for a while, I had forgotten about that. But truly, it's one of my proudest moments of doing something that really not only impacts families, but kids that are in distress. And there's a whole psychology behind it. So, and sometimes you have to be reminded of that. You know, it was always stuck in the back of my mind. And people say in interviews, you know, when we're interviewing for a project, what's your favorite hotel? Or what is your favorite project? And sometimes you forget. But that really was one of the most amazing experiences that I've ever had, for sure.
going back to this whole idea of hard work and rolling up your sleeves, there's one story that I always make you tell that you told me once, but it was about you had some clients coming in, but you needed to kind of show some good face at Wilson Associates, and you brought in some help, some friends and phones, right?
Oh, this is Trisha.
That's Trisha.
This is how Trisha started. Okay. And, you know, it's amazing when you have a mentor like that, because I'll tell you the best thing about Trisha. So when she started, she was trying to get work with Trammell Crow, and that's how she got into the hospitality business, was he was building the Anatole in Dallas, Texas. And she had done some restaurant work, but she wanted to get the restaurants in the Anatole. And she had no employees, so she hired a bunch of friends to come in, phones that weren't even plugged in, put people at desks, and brought Trammell Crow in there, and that's how she got her job. But the one thing that I was thinking about it this morning when you sent me through the questions, it was interesting. You have to be pretty fearless to build these big companies. Yeah. And the thing that she taught me, when I was at Wilson, some of my greatest moments when we were thinking of strategy and what we wanted to do, I would call her and say, what do you think about this? And it was really kind of some sort of crazy idea that I'd come up with. And she goes, well, just ask yourself, what's the worst thing that could happen? That was the business plan. Like, what's the worst thing that could happen? It wouldn't work. And then we would just stop doing it. So that is one of the great lessons that I've learned from her. And I constantly have to remind myself of that, because you could be very gun shy about doing certain things. And she instilled in me, you know, listen, what we do isn't going to kill anybody. We're not finding the cure for cancer. Now, maybe if we were erecting buildings and, you know, dealing with engineers, but interior design, you know, that's all the soft spot stuff. So it's about being a little bit fearless, yeah. I think.
I love that.
Yeah.
So speaking of being fearless, you decided to take a leap of faith and go help WATG build Wimberly Interiors, mm-hmm. you know, after a very long time, or a good amount of time.
Let's just say Wilson. It, over 30 years. Yeah. It is what it is.
Yeah. But why did you decide to take your career in a different direction and try something new?
You know, Wilson had been The business had been changing a bit for our company. And as you know now, they've been sold to the Chinese. So I was there when there was an equity partner that was involved. And the equity partner came in before 08, when Oprah Winfrey was our client, when I was working with Andre Agassi and Steffi Graf, when, you know, it was a really sexy, fun business to be in. And then after 08, when, you know, it sort of all came crashing down on us, suddenly the rules had changed a bit. And, you know, Trisha always said, do great design and financial success will follow. And that was absolutely our mantra. And it started to feel a little bit different. But what really did it was, and I'm probably just getting a little bit too schmaltzy, but I had mentored and raised a lot of kids in this business, you know? And I saw them starting to get married and have families and leave. And I thought, God, I've been here for so long. I, you know, this is when it dawned on me. What happened was there was a potential client who I thought was a potential client who turned out to be a headhunter who came to my office, went out totally on his own to find me. And when he told me the proposition of it's WATG and they want you to run interiors for them, it is the only firm, and I also say this all the time too, it's the only architecture firm that I ever would have left Wilson for, ever. Well, any firm that I would have left Wilson for. That I had worked with them on the St. Regis in Singapore. I'd worked with them on projects in California. Just really great guys who've worked with the great design firms, and they knew that they weren't doing it very well. So when you start to line all that up, I realized I did very little due diligence. It's kind of scary what I based my decision on. It was really scary what I based my decision on. But I decided that if I don't do this, I'm going to become the old lady who stayed too long and had nothing good to say, which, you know, I run into some of those ladies every once in a while. And listen, I run into guys who do that, but I'm just talking about myself. And I knew that I had one or two more good moves in me, and I just needed to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're obviously don't regret it because now you've
no,
been there.
No, I don't.
There.
Not at all. Not at all.
Been there almost 8 years. What has it been like forming this interiors group in a bigger architecture firm? I mean,
scary.
Yeah.
Scary. And, you know, so if you look at Wilson now, they're owned by the Chinese and architectural group. If you look at HBA, they're owned by Gold Mantis, which is an architecture, but, you know, it's millwork and everything else. If you look at Deborah Lloyd Forrest, she's merged. If you look at BBG, they've merged with HOK. So when I did it, it was still thought that, ooh, you're going to a bad side by going to the architects. And that was a little bit scary. But for some reason, and maybe ignorance is bliss, you know, for some reason I thought I could pull it off. You know, I just thought that I could pull it off. So when I joined, if you can imagine, so 30 years that you've built your career, you know who to have lunch with, you know who are the nice people in the schoolyard, you know who the mean girls are, you know who, you know, the head honcho is, and you build this comfort level. Well, it's like starting a new school all over again. And I had to, no one knew me, and I had to win hearts and minds. And I still say to this day, our first line of clients are the architects. You know, they're the first guys in the room for a project. So I have to tell you, they've been insanely supportive. The only reason that Wemberly is where it is today is because of the horsepower of WATG and that brand. It's just incredible. But they're also an incredible group of professionals and super talented architects.
Yeah.
So it's, and I will say that we're a trust. So we're an employee-owned firm. It has that family atmosphere that Wilson had, even though Wilson was global. It had that real family feel to it. Which is really important to me.
Yeah.
You know, people asked me right after it happened, people like, if I had known that you were looking, you know, I would have come after you. And I think that people don't understand that that's the only firm that I would have left for. And people also ask me, why didn't you start your own firm? I'm good with a group. I'm not good solo.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to have lots of people around me. So that's how.
And you've grown. I mean, in 8 years, you guys have had amazing growth.
Yeah, we've had amazing growth. We've also, what we're really lucky about is that people have had incredible faith in us to take a leap of faith with us. I will say that I think that we really arrived when Ted Jacobs and Alia Khan hired us to do the first Bentley Suite in New York. That's when we really... We got a lot of press out of that. We got a lot of work out of that. And that's when we could really put our flag in. I will say Host was incredibly loyal to us. And Helen Jorgensen just hired us to do a project pretty darn quickly, which was great. And then, to be honest with you, you know, I had made a verbal agreement with Tricia that I would never use the portfolio, I would never take a single employee, and I would never go after clients, and I didn't. And what's been really nice is that we are working with clients that we've never worked with before, which is pretty liberating, to be honest with you, you know? And we've been able to forge ahead on our own, which also feels really good.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty impressive that you said all that to Tricia. I mean, that's not an easy...
Well, you know, and we were just emailing last night. It was her birthday was in August, but she just got her birthday present last night. You know, all we have in this industry... Listen, this is how I think. I don't know if it's right or wrong, but I really believe that all I have is my reputation. And I try to be an honest, good person. And, you know, I've watched people leave firms, and I also believe in karma too. I'm a big karma person. And my mother always said her greatest line to me was, well, there are two great lines from her. Margaret, two wrongs don't make a right, which I always use. And the other one is treat people how you would want to be treated. So I just live my life that way. And Tricia not only was my employer, but she's a dear, dear friend of mine. So that was really important to me to maintain.
Right. I mean, you spending 30 years with somebody and growing a firm, I mean, that...
It wasn't just that. Yeah. You know, we exchanged Christmas presents, birthday presents. She was at my, both my parents' funeral when I was 25 years old. I mean, I was with her longer than I've been with my husband. Mm. So she was like a, I don't want to say a sister or a mother, you know, but she was a combination of both of those, you know. Mm. She absolutely opened the world to me that I did not know existed. Didn't know it existed. Had no idea.
It's amazing. And now that you're at Wimberly, what are some of the great projects that you're working on? What are you trying to do with the firm, you know, to kind of push the limits and do something, you know, great work?
You know, and we've talked about this with, first of all, you can't do anything without great talent. That's absolutely got to be the foundation of I can't do any of this without my great teams. So, you know, and it's scary when you build a brand because you could sit there and go, so is the honeymoon over? Or, you know, we've built this, now what do we do? And I also believe that when you look at brands in any industry, you can kill a brand a whole lot quicker than it takes to build a brand. And we wanted to make sure that we were moving in the right strategic direction. So all of my studio directors, we worked together to talk about, now it's about growth. So Raj Chantanani is a huge part of that with our strategic proposition and what markets we need to go into and what we need to do. Right now, I mean, we're viewed as luxury within the market. We're doing some of the projects that we're talking about. We're doing a Four Seasons in Cartagena. We're doing more Belmont train cars out of London. We are doing a 10-bedroom private home in the center of Paris right now. So we're known for luxury. But as I've always said, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. And quite honestly, my designers need to be challenged and they need to work outside the box. So we're looking at bringing some talent in that can change up who we are. And I was talking to someone recently and they walked in and just a really, really cool guy. And he was kind of like, I said, it's perfect that you don't look like us. You don't sound like us. And that's exactly why we love you, you know? So it's really about growth to make sure that we can cover other segments of the market. We want to be in more lifestyle, like limited service, things like that. We really want to make our residential more robust. Our F&B has been lagging behind, so that's important for us as well. So those are the things that we're looking at right now.
Interesting. And let's talk a little bit about these Belmont train cars, because I think it's really interesting that how the trip is becoming as exciting as the destination, which, you know, it's happening with airplanes and, you know, cruise ships and now these luxury train cars, which to me says a lot about where this industry is headed and, you know, how travel is changing.
Yeah.
Has that been an exciting project to...
It's been incredibly exciting. So London did the first one, the SVOE train that launched, I think, 2 months ago, and it is booked 3 years out. They are now getting ready to do, I think it's 5 more train cars. So the whole concept of how they do those is so fascinating. Singapore is also working on a train car for Belmont as well. And what's interesting is, like a hotel, a sense of place of where is the train car going to be? So the train car that they're doing out of Asia has got a spa car in it, where the one that London's doing has got a dining car, a living room car, and then 3 bedroom cars. And they're very, very fast track. But it's that whole experience, because I very much agree with you. Even when you start to look at not just how you get there, but I think when you really look at what is the hotel room. I was just talking to someone in London that I had a meeting with, and they're looking at doing windowless hotel rooms, no windows, and they're doing it right now. I'll tell you after we do this interview who it is. But I found that fascinating. We had a debate in our office. I said, you know what? I don't necessarily need a window. I don't, actually. And if there is this sort of faked out view or scenery, I don't open the windows in my hotel. And also, too, depending on what the view is. So it's, I think the whole experience is really changing. I love the glamping concept. You know, I love just building platforms and doing something. I think that it'll tie in much different experiences that we're talking about. You know, we're talking about, this morning we were talking about in our office, like, why don't you see anyone aside from in Nashville jamming in a lobby? You know, why don't you see an artist in residence? Why don't you see any of that? And I think that the whole experiential thing will constantly be evolving. Yeah. We're just going to have to top ourselves all the time, you know? It's
makes your jobs more fun and harder at the same time.
Yeah, it can hurt your brain sometimes. Anyway.
Well, you know, and what, talking about that, what is some of your biggest challenges at work? I mean, besides the industry always changing, you know, what else kind of keeps you up at night?
What keeps me, I'll tell you what keeps me up at night. It's probably management. Yeah. Management keeps me up at night, that's for sure. And how do you keep growing the business without it getting stale and without it looking, we don't want to be a one-trick wonder, you know? We don't want to be that. And a lot of it has to do with keeping your talent motivated. And you don't want to paint yourself into one box, you know? We have a couple of projects that are up for awards this year, and it's all super high-end luxury. And my team loves doing, London is doing some stuff now. They're doing senior living, which is really interesting. I know that my team in New York loves doing residential. They love doing that. But you've got to always keep them motivated too, you know? So that's mainly what keeps me up at night. Mm-hmm. Yeah, is having the right talent and managing all of it.
Right.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, so you have an office in London, office in New York, office in LA, and Singapore?
And Singapore. Then we have satellite offices in Shanghai and in Dubai. And what we knew was we started Shanghai. There were, we knew that we had to have an office there because we just opened Suning Bellagio. And I remember going in there 2 years ago and getting on the phone saying, we've got to move people over here. We got to get people on the ground to make sure that this project is a success. So we found we had a BD guy who works remotely. All the BD people sort of work remotely, but we knew that we had to have a project manager. We needed an FF&E person. So we've got four people in Shanghai right now. Mm-hmm. Dubai, we knew that we needed to establish an office. We had a BD guy there. But we were doing the Kempinski Mall, the Emirates, and we were doing that renovation. And as you know, doing a renovation in the same city that you're in is challenging enough, let alone halfway across the world. So we have a project manager, FF&E coordinator, and an architect in Dubai. So that's where we are right now. We're looking at doing it very organically. Mm-hmm. Wherever the need is, if we can, I don't want to say do a pop-up, but if we need to go in and have people on the ground, we're nimble enough that we can do that. And if we can partner up with someone or if we can find some opportunity that makes sense for short term, it may become long term. So we're doing it very organically.
And has that helped? I mean, seeing it now with Shanghai and Dubai, I mean,
huge. Yeah, it's been huge. And that's part of being fearless, you know. We did Shanghai. The architects are now, we're going to expand Shanghai. And we're going to add architects and I think landscaper planners. So listen, it's about not being afraid to fail. And that's the thing about, you can pitch your tent and if you need to break it down and get out of town, you can do that too. So that has been really helpful for us. Dubai, we're trying to still figure out. Saudi has suddenly become a huge market for us. So how we grow that studio, time will tell. But Saudi could be a tremendous market.
Got it. And it probably has helped with your clients and showing them, you know, that you're all in. Because, I mean, collaboration goes both ways. So you giving a little bit more, you know, might prove longer term, do you think, a little bit, to have these relationships with these clients continue?
Absolutely. The way that we got the 10-bedroom house in Paris is crazy. So who wouldn't want to do a 10-bedroom house in Paris? We weren't even looking for it. And it was a family member. When we did Kempinski Mall of the Emirates, it's Majid Al Futtaim. So there are two Futtaim families, Al Futtaim families. So someone went from working for Majid and went over to work for the Al Futtaim group, which is the cousin that owns all the car dealerships. And someone went to go work for him. Omar Al Futtaim was doing a house and he was looking for, you know, someone to finish it up and do the interior design. And he was struggling with the whole thing. And the gentleman who had worked for Majid Al Futtaim said, you need to call these people in New York and they will get it done for you. So you never know. This is a super small, it's not only a small industry, but it's a small world. And what you want to do is just, and we always talk about this too. It's funny, clients don't remember the great things that you did for them, but they remember the last, you know, oops that you made. And we were very successful at the Kempinski Mall of the Emirates, and knock on wood, that led to something that we didn't even see coming. Yeah.
And a 10-bedroom house is almost like a small little hotel.
Well, I keep joking with the owner. I said, you know, if you ever want to sell this is a Soho house. We're you know, they dug down two stories to put in an indoor pool. And the conversations that we're having, we call the living room a country club downstairs. And it could be, and we keep joking about it, but it could be a Soho house.
Yeah, that's amazing. A little different than our houses here in New York.
Yes, a little bit over in Brooklyn.
And how, so you've all, you know, amazing teams, a lot of different offices. As, you know, the leader of, you know, Wimberly Interiors, how involved are you still with the design details? I mean, how do you handle it? I know every kind of head does it differently, but how do you handle
it? Well, the other thing that I was taught is hire people that are better than you and let them do their jobs. The one thing that I think that I bring, and I'm not involved in every single project. Right. There are clients who request that I be involved, and I love that. And there are projects that I really want to be involved with. And I think that the most valuable thing that I bring to a project is my experience. I'll just give you the best recent example. So when we were doing the Rosewood down in Bahamar, we had, and that was a challenging renovation. I mean, we had to transform that property. And we had Silver Hill Studios was doing all of the murals in the lobby, which I don't know if you saw those, but they were key to the design for the lobby. So I said to my team, probably 3 months before opening, where are we on the murals? And they said, well, the contractor has it under control. And I said, well, what do you mean? What does that mean? They said, well, we put it on our finish schedule that, you know, the murals, they've got to contact Silver Hill. And I said, well, if you're expecting that to happen, you are mental. So I called up Silver Hill. I said, have you been contacted? They said, no. So then I called a contractor on site. I'm like, have you called Silver Hill? They said, no. So luckily, I have a very good relationship with the owner at CTF. And I called him up and I said, this is a big deal. This is a really big deal that we have to have happen. He goes, well, I know nothing about it. Da, da, da. So it's things like that. So we got it done. We had conference calls after conference calls, and it was critical that because they were painting on site, they did all the painting on site. And sometimes I think that people, the definition of getting a job done is not just conveying the information. It's not just counting on someone else to get it done. It's double checking and triple checking those certain things that you take for granted are going to happen, but don't necessarily happen. So I think from my experience, and I probably had enough hell-raising experiences that have kept me up at night where I know those pressure points to look at.
Yeah.
So I think that that's probably where I'm best suited.
Yeah. Was there one early in your career that kind of
oh, God.
You remember?
I wish it were one. I wish it were one. Well, one of them involved a freight elevator. I will tell you that. So I always have my team say, you got to check the size of the freight elevator. And another one was when I was doing a project out in New Orleans, as a matter of fact. And I remember waking up in the middle of the night, just when you have that aha moment, you're hyperventilating, you're like, oh my God, what's going to happen here? And how did you do with the desk? A mill worker was making the top of the desk, and then we had a metal worker making the base. Two totally different people doing it. And I thought, oh my God, what if the top doesn't fit on the base? You know when you have those sort of crazy moments? I called the purchasing agent the next day, who I don't think they're any longer in business, but it was Dan Shapiro out of California and Verna Kerigian. This woman, she's still in the business somewhere. Unbelievable. I called her. I was just watching my phone till it was 9 o'clock in LA. And I called her and I said, oh my God, Verna, I woke up in the middle of the night. She goes, don't worry. I sent the desk to the metal workers, you know? So the moral to that story is that you want to be working with a really good seasoned team that knows all the pitfalls, because you can't possibly think of them all. Mm-hmm. You can't possibly. So we're lucky also too that in all the work that we've been doing since we've been Wemberly, we've had great teams, great clients, great operators, and great consultants helping us along the way.
Which is lucky.
Yeah, we are lucky. We are lucky. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there things that, you know, even people on your team or other designers do that you just, you know, little pet peeves?
Yeah, I've got a few of them. Listen, I'm super old school, and I was trained to design to budgets, you know? And there are some pet peeves in my office where people will be like, well, that's the purchasing agent's job, you know? And I shouldn't say this if clients are going to listen to this podcast, but I'm going to say it anyway. You know, there are certain people like, let's leave, that's the purchasing agent's job. That annoys me quite a bit. And also, too, I think that when you do that, a big part of it is that you lose control. When you leave it to somebody else to do, you've forfeited control over what it is you want this thing to look like and feel like. So that's one of my pet peeves. Another one of my pet peeves is, and I've learned to control it a bit. I'm very much, everyone has to be at work at a certain time. And I've learned with millennials that, you know, you can't necessarily be a clock watcher. And that is one of my, I've learned to loosen up, you know. I meditate every morning and I think about it. I've learned to loosen up, that there are different ways. I used to always say, I don't care how you get there, just get there at the time and the place that you need to get there. But the game has changed a bit. And I have to get rid of my sort of old school mentality. I really have to learn to get rid of that.
Yeah. No, I feel your pain.
Okay, good.
Wait, talking about the meditation, that's something new that you've added.
I've done it for a couple of years now. And because my husband is, you know, we go home at night, you go home to your great husband and your three kids, and I go home to my husband, and he really does coach me. It's like, you are completely out of control. You are just completely off the rails. So I started meditating, and everyone knows this, I love Andrew from Headspace. I'm, you know, with him every morning in this one chair in my living room. My sister Anne this week was like, I have a meditation pillow. And I said, no. I sit in one chair in the morning, and it's how I really start my day. It's how I'm a super early riser. And so I talk to Singapore, and some days I don't. I'll talk to Singapore, I'll talk to London or Dubai. And I've realized I need to cut that off. And because it'll get me so revved up and crazy that I realize I need to set that aside and I need to start my day. So I meditate every morning. Yeah. And then I go work out and then I come home and then I see, you know, the hellstorm that's emails or some issue going on. Yeah. And then I deal with it. Yeah.
Has your husband said it's helped you?
You know, I've been married for 33 years. So, he said that it has, but listen, our husbands are great. They look out for us and they worry about us, you know. And Mike, a lot of times, is up in the country, but for the last several months, as you know, he's been living in New York. And he'll walk in at about 4:30 in the morning and go, were you on the phone? And I'll say, yeah, of course I'm on the phone, you know. And all these guys know that they can call me super early in the morning. So that is, I try to keep that to a minimum. But yeah. Listen, we all are a work in progress until the day we die.
Well, and work-life balance is hard.
Yeah.
I mean.
Well, you have three kids. God bless you.
Thanks. Yeah.
I just have a husband in New York, and I have three dogs that I haven't seen in months. But I don't know how. I will tell you, working moms are true heroes to me. I really mean that. I mean that.
Thank you. Some days it's better than others, but yeah. We make it work. So looking back now and everything you've done and these amazing projects you've done and great clients, what did you ever think you'd end up where you are today? I mean, I know Trisha saw something that
no.
you didn't see.
Not at all. Not at all. You know, I didn't grow up in a you got to remember, this was the 70s. My mother very much, I remember when I told her I was going to get married. And I can't believe I'm saying this, but she said, you don't have to do this, you know. And that was the one thing that I was like, whoa. But as I said, my parents passed away at 25. And if I, you know, if I had time to really sit down and ask her to explain that statement, but you know, back then it was like, have a family. And the fact that I don't have kids was even still very controversial. I remember guys in meetings, it was amazing how guys would be like, so do you have any kids? Which I know it's a point of conversation. I'd be like, no. And they're like, why? So it's very interesting. So when I grew up, you were supposed to get married and have kids and maybe have a job or whatever. And I honestly, for most people, my husband always says, he goes, God, man, I remember you when you were like a stoner windsurfer. And I really was. And he goes, you didn't have a care in the world. And he said, a switch flipped. He's convinced it's when my parents both died, which I don't know really what that means. But I think that for me, I was so lucky to find the world that I did. It was miraculous for me. I just loved it. It was like my crack, you know? It was my addiction that this whole world opened up to me that I just couldn't get enough of. And it wasn't just the work, it was the people. It was the people. You know, the first time I went on a plane, I was in high school.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like I'd traveled the world or anything.
And now you have.
Yeah. Yeah, I have. I'm very lucky. Insanely lucky.
Well, I always say that this industry is special, especially because of the people in it. You
yeah.
don't find this level of smart, creative, motivated people that you find in most industries. But I might be biased after 16 years.
I don't think that you're biased. And I think the difference is, so my husband was on Wall Street and he was a trader. And I would hear, he's retired for quite some time, but I would hear stories, even in, you know, my sister's in the garment industry and my brother's in aviation. I find nothing more enjoyable than the fact that we can sit in the room with our competitors, and maybe there's some competitors we can't sit in the same room with, but that we can sit in a room with our competitors and have open dialogue that makes us all better. And I haven't seen that in any other industry. I haven't.
No, it's very true. And it's something I think that's even gotten better throughout the years.
Well, you guys in your business have been key to all of that.
Oh, thank you.
And it's not just because I'm sitting in your office talking to you, but you guys have helped create a community that is pretty darn special.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hard to find. How has the industry changed? I mean, it's changed so much, but what do you think are, you know, maybe one or two of the biggest changes you've seen in your career?
You know, it's interesting. It's not just about designing hotels. It's understanding what ails people, what motivates people, what not only the great things that are happening in the world, but what some of the challenges in the world are. And I think that the whole concept of creating community in hotels right now is interesting. I was on a round table, and it was someone from Clota's office, as a matter of fact, who, and that woman is such a genius, it's ridiculous. They said the biggest ailment, and I could be quoting this incorrectly, but the last statement I know is accurate, said the biggest ailment plaguing the world right now is loneliness. We would never talk about stuff like that. We would never talk about it. It's like, is it pretty? Is it got a sense of place? You know, is it appropriate? Does it work for the brand? And I think that the conversation is getting longer and more interesting. That's what I find. And it's not just about nuts and bolts and designing a space. It goes much deeper than that, I think. And what I love about the industry is that, you know, it used to be all the big players back in the 80s. It was HBA, it was Wilson, and a whole bunch of other ones. But now you're seeing different firms coming into the space who had never done hospitality before, which is really refreshing. And I used to say that residential influences hospitality, but I think that hospitality, it's flipped again. Mm-hmm. I think that hospitality is influencing residential, which is exciting.
Yeah. And a lot of other niches as well, you know, like co-working and office space and even healthcare.
Yeah. Without a doubt. Without a doubt. Yeah.
I think it's, I've said this a couple of times, I think it's the most exciting time, at least in my career, that this industry has seen.
Well, and you think about innovation and how they use that in hotels. It'll completely change how we work. I was just watching on the news this morning that I think Yale developed an artificial skin that can make inanimate objects move, can give motion to them. So they took this like skin and put it on a stuffed animal. And suddenly the stuffed animal was walking all over the place. And you just think about, like, for me, I've just mastered my iPhone, for God's sakes, you know? That's as far as I've gone. So when you think about things like that and where the world can go with all of this, it's scary, but it's really cool.
Yeah, really exciting. So what's next for you? What is there something you haven't done that you still want to do, or, you know, any big kind of plans?
I think the growth for us will be really important. I think that taking the New York studio. So WATG never had a plan to open a New York studio. I just told them I wouldn't live anywhere else. So like, okay, I guess we got to have an office for you. So we started the studio, and now it's about me pulling back and getting someone in that studio to help lead it so that I can focus on growth globally, which is really important. You know, I travel a ton now, but it's really getting that growth right, which is really important. So I think it's the second stage. I helped build the brand. Now it's taking the brand to the next level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure as always.
So much fun.
I really appreciate
this. Anything for you, my darling.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to Hospitality Design's What I've Learned. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find full episodes and transcripts at hospitalitydesign.com.